CIA, motherfucker.
Wise man say, forgiveness is divine, but never pay full price for late pizza. Cause you're a freak with a microphone.
I am an FBI agent.
You're listening to the Super Podcast, featuring hosts Super Marcy.
And I think everybody these days can relate to Serial Mom.
And Pete the Terrible Aussie.
But one of my pet peeves in movies, like people sitting down to have dinner and they don't actually finish the dinner.
This podcast contains coarse language.
See, watching this, like, I just want to go and
adult themes.
Like, the whole, this whole movie is just hinges on someone's ass.
And potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
Listener discretion is advised. Visit supermarcy.com for more information. Now for our feature presentation.
Listen, sister, if I want your opinion, I'll beat it out of you.
By the way, his testicle retrieval operation went quite well.
White Russian. No ice. Hold the vodka. Hold the Kahlua.
Isn't this 4215 pussy way?
Hey everyone, this is B. Jamide, aka The Terrible Aussie, and welcome to episode 171 of The Super Podcast. And with me, as always, is my very awesome co-host, the one and only Super Marcy. Hello, how are you?
Hello, I'm doing really well, Bede. How are you doing today?
Oh, not too bad, thanks. Not too bad, Marcy. We have a very exciting episode for our listeners today, which I'm very, very happy about. And yeah, I would have to say, Marcy, this is definitely going to be a good one that I think everyone's going to enjoy listening to.
Yeah, definitely. We have three very awesome guests to discuss a film that is currently doing the festival circuit, at least here in Australia, and hopefully we'll get some more news about it as time rolls on, but we'll get to that, and I hope everybody enjoys.
Definitely. So for this episode of the show, we had the opportunity to sit down and interview writer-director David Ward, co-writer Josie Hess, and producer and star Nicholas Giacchino to talk about their film, Lenore. So here we go, everyone. Here is our interview with David, Josie, and Nick.
I'm Max.
I'm a filmmaker.
It is a tribute.
Brand Christmas present.
Just moved in, have you?
Yes.
How long ago?
Not long.
You on your own?
Yes.
Hi, everyone. I don't even know where to start.
She's an artist, a revolutionary, a goddess.
We have to talk about the internet's most dangerous artist, Lenore.
I bore myself and my soul, and the world didn't end for a while.
You know what happened,
don't you?
She's gone, Maxie.
Hey everyone, this is Bede Jamide, and with me, of course, is Super Marcy. And on today's special episode of the Super Podcast, we have three very special guests joining us today. And they're here to talk about their latest film that all three have worked together on, which, of course, is the psychological horror thriller Lenore, which is currently playing as part of the Fantastic Film Festival Australia. And joining us today are the film's co-writer-director, David Ward, co-writer, Josie Hess, and the film star, Nicholas Giacchino. Hello, everybody. How are you?
Great, man. Great. How are you?
Not too bad. Not too bad, thank you. Well, Marcy and I are glad that you are all here today to talk about your film, Lenore, and we both really enjoyed it. And we're very excited that this film is currently doing the festival circuit at the moment. How you feel about that?
Kind of like you. I'm just excited that people are now actually getting to see it because, God, Josie and I go all the way back to, 2020 on this project, something like that. Nick and I go back even further on this project, all the way back to when it was a stage play in sort of 2016, 2017, and a completely different lifetime for all of us. So this has been about a decade coming, honestly. And so now that it's actually happening, it's pretty surreal, honestly. But beyond surreal, it's also incredibly gratifying and very humbling. And I'm glad I'm doing it with so many great people as well.
Definitely, definitely. But I guess, like, obviously, this film is from a stage play. So how did the process of wanting to turn the original stage play version of this story to adapt it to a film? How did that come together?
Well, probably the best way to answer that is to tell you what ended up happening with the stage version of the film. So all the way back in, like I said, 2015, 2016, I was working with an independent theatre company here in Melbourne. And we had just done a couple of sort of site-specific theatre productions that have been well-received. And they had a horror thriller theme to them. And like I say, they went down really well. And we as a company went, okay, well, let's do that again, but let's do an original adaptation because we were working with other people's texts. So we all, myself and the two other directors at the company, we all put our heads together and decided, and we settled on Edgar Allan Poe as a writer whose body of work we wanted to adapt for both for practical reasons and for artistic reasons. Practical because it's in the public domain, it's free to use, you can freely adapt it. But then we also, I speaking just purely for myself, I just really liked all of the, it seemed to me that Poe was always orbiting similar sorts of ideas and similar themes, and that maybe characters are shared across texts. So that was the sort of starting point for me as a stage play, which I worked on with my collaborators at the company for a couple of years, and then the project fell down and the company disbanded. And so the project as a stage play, it kind of died then and there. And this happened in around about 2018, I want to say. And I wasn't going to get to do it as a play because I really liked the material. I thought there was a lot of potential there, but I also felt like I needed help moving it along, that I didn't have the breadth of my experience and imagination wasn't quite wide enough to get to the thing that I was really trying to get to. And so I chipped away at it for a couple of years on my own, from let's say like 2018 through to the pandemic. And then that's when Josie came on board as my co-writer on the project. And we spent a good, I don't know, like 14, 15 months, something like that, just scrutinizing the thing as it already existed with the intention of turning it into a film. And then we slowly, just very iteratively, chipped away at it together and ended up with the thing that you see now. So very organic, very iterative process, I would say.
And Josie, I'm kind of curious as well, with being brought on to the film to write it, how did that come about, and what was the process of bringing your perspective to this story?
And was it just through memes? To add in something, because I'm super quiet for some reason.
We definitely did a lot via memes, yes. So David and I have worked together since film school. I think we were the weird kids. Forgive me, David, but I feel like that's what we were.
No, 100%.
We were both obsessed with body horror. We loved Cronenberg. So I think it was the middle of the pandemic or early in pandemic, and David reached out with this like fucking crazy concept. And I was like, oh, fuck yeah. I want to spend a couple hours every week chipping away at this with you. So I think, like David said, it was really iterative. And I think what really drew me to the project was I'm a child of the internet myself. I felt a lot of relationship with Lenore's character. And I thought that together, we kind of both were holding these spaces of like bringing our internet history and deep lore into the script. So it was an incredibly fun project to do in some deep, dark times that we were going through. So yeah, it was just like a really fun thing to sink into and work on with David after years of being obsessed with the same types of films.
And I think that is worth mentioning, is that, just to reiterate what you were just saying then, Josie, it was the pandemic. It was a really it was a horrible time. And so I mean, speaking only for myself, we were generally speaking, like we met every Wednesday just on Zoom, and we would just spend a couple of hours just shooting the shit and talking. And sometimes we would talk about the material. Sometimes we would just talk about anything and everything that was happening in the world. And I was also having concurrent conversations with Nick, because as I mentioned earlier, Nick has been involved in this project for almost as long as I have, and was doing a hell of a lot of work and sort of solo rehearsal in the background on this Max character. And so every now and again, Nick would hand me his research, which would then go back to Josie, and then we would find ways to integrate all of that into the text. And so, yeah, I don't mean to keep reiterating this phrase, but organic and iterative is what it is, really, really what it felt like. But I just really loved seeing Josie once a week and just and just hanging out and working on this thing together. I think it very much kept me sane during the pandemic.
Yeah, I relate to that, because I feel like we were at our creative peaks in lockdown because there was not much else to do. I'm like, how were we more social in lockdowns?
And when are we ever going to, when will we ever get that level of free time ever again?
That's crazy.
If the pandemic hadn't have happened, the film probably wouldn't have happened. Like, that was the only reason I was able to sort of put my, I was able to get my head, myself in the weeds and figure out, okay, who's got money? Who can invest in this thing? How can, and yeah, being given arbitrarily 2 years to just full time chip away on this very strange, tricky little project was a real godsend. I wouldn't wish the pandemic on anybody a second
just to
time.
Be clear, no.
Just to be clear, I would not wish that on my worst enemy. But no, thank God we had that we were working on together, because yeah, it really kept me sane, and it gave us something to look forward to on the other side of it as well.
We would wish for such ample social welfare again, I think, is my thing. I think the job seeker and job keeper really helped the creative process, even if the productive process was a bit lower.
Yeah, true.
I mean, I'm just saying we shouldn't look fondly back on that time, but now I kind of do, and that's a bit weird.
You just like a little weekend lockdown here and there. That's all. Just a little mini one.
Sometimes
just
I wonder
the,
if
they had that week off just so you could just do something creative, and that's about.
Yeah, sometimes I wonder if, like, if when you know how, like, sometimes pressure builds up in boilers too much and you have to like release the pressure valve a little bit. Sometimes I feel like we should just do that. Like every now and again, like some, like an adult should just step into the room and go, everybody chill. It's getting too much. We're all going to sit down for a week and not go to work.
Yes.
I kind of wish we still did that. Fingers crossed.
I mean, I almost feel like maybe the character of Max needed to have switched off for quite a while.
Quite possibly, yes.
I mean, you'd have no movie, but...
but, yeah, well, yeah, I was going to say, Nick, like, as David said, you, Kate, were there from the very beginning. How much are... So you brought a lot of input into the character of Max. What was that process of developing this character that we see in the film?
Well, to be honest, it started off not so much as me coming on board as the actor, but more just me coming on board as just like another peer to sort of share work with. David and I had just come off the back of doing a play in 2015 with, you know, not altogether dissimilar kind of tones, I suppose, like quite
true, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. Quite a dark and sort of savage play. For the theatre heads listening, it was Gruesome Playground Injuries by Rajiv Joseph. And so, like, that was kind of the beginning of our, like, we'd been mates prior to that, but that had been the kind of the beginning of our collaborative relationship and work. But I started more just as, like, just being there to give my impressions of, like, what I thought of this as a play, what I thought of this character, what I thought of these visuals. I was very early in my career as an actor, and even earlier still in my career as a screenwriter, which I've gone on to become now as well. Odd little tidbit, I was actually 1 year ahead of David and Josie at the same film school.
Yes. And not to interrupt you, but we met.
Yeah, we met on a third year film, I think, from your graduating class.
Yeah, we were both acting in it, and that's how we met, and we just hit it off like immediately.
Yeah, he gave me lifts home, which was also really handy because I didn't have my license at the time. It becomes fast friends when someone's got a car. But no, like, as soon as I read the play, and I think at the time that I read it, it was sort of just the first act, like I immediately was like, I don't want to be rude and overstep my bounds, but at some point I need to talk to him about auditioning for this character or what the odds would be if I could play this character. And David very kindly just said to me in 2017, like, yeah, it's yours if you want it, duh. Which was like the easiest casting meeting I've ever had in my life. But I guess the process of creating Max from then on, while David and Josie were sort of working on structure and working on the other characters like Lenore, and of course working on Max as well, but mainly working on the story, I was sort of going off to just figure out who this guy was. And because it was such like a slow cooking process for this film, I had all of these moments. It was almost like once a year, I would do like a 2 to 3 month intensive with this guy, starting from childhood. And it's a kind of a luxury that I doubt I'll ever really have again, given the way that the processes of like making these things works. But we had some false starts, which also meant like, I've got more time. I've got all this stuff. I've got to put it in the cupboard for a bit. But it was like finding real world equivalents. I think I may have watched the video diaries of a number of unhealthy people. I read the manifestos of some even more unhealthy people. Came up with backstories. I invented a handwriting style for this guy because it just could not be me. Certain things from that research also influenced how I looked, like how my weight was, like shaving my head. Those were all things that came from sort of my research brought back to David, and then to say like, I'm kind of vibing with this. What do you reckon? And I remember actually, I think it was the first time, Josie, you and I probably met, which was when we saw a play at the Art Center. And in between you and I bonding over the fact that we were both pro wrestling fans, we spoke about the hair thing. And I remember you saying to me, like, you'd always envisioned him as like a long haired, greasy boy.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, but I think he is that. But I reckon he thinks he's Robert De Niro in Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
You know,
you were right.
Yeah.
I think it would have worked, in all honesty, I think it would have worked both ways. That there was just, we have had some people come to us, a couple of reviewers and someone who moderated our Q&A when we were in Sydney, who actually picked out the inspiration for that head shave, who was Ricardo Lopez, the infamous stalker of Bjork, who recorded about 100 hours of his video diary on why and who he was and why he was doing this and the process of him, how he was plotting to try and murder her. So, you know, it was all worth it in the end. Everything got used in some way or another. There are like little Easter eggs that only the three of us would get from that film.
I was going to add, like, someone like Max, and I don't know if this is probably a bad thing, but just me living my life in, born in the 80s, you live through the 90s, 2000s, seeing the evolution of our technology, internet, all these things. And through all that time, like, I have encountered people very similar to Max, and it actually kind of like really unsettled me watching the film, because he's not just kind of one person. There are so many quite like this, and it's really disturbing. Like, some little mannerisms or something that I saw just gave me the chills, because I've experienced that. And like, you all like completely like nailed it with,
thank you,
like everything to, but even just like references to things that have happened, like broadcast intrusion and things like that. Like, straight away I'm thinking, oh, everyone's favorite Max Headroom intrusion for whatever reason.
Yep.
During Doctor Who and bits and pieces like that. Like, it all kind of comes together. But at the same time, it makes sense because we've lived through all these things, and there's always that like memory. Like, I might not always remember that happened, but I remember now.
And the time, we always used to say on set, and I think we probably said it while we were writing, that it's a film that kind of takes place in nowhere land, because we like you, I remember all of that stuff. I wasn't there when Max Headroom happened, but like I've seen those videos. Josie and I talked about all of this stuff very extensively. Mm. Like we talked about alternate reality games. There was a huge amount of cultural detritus that was going into this material. And like Nick said, it's all in there. It all happened. But the reason the film's period is sort of vague and nebulous is so that it can contain all of this stuff, because a spooky tweet is just not enough. Like there's something about the tactility and the physical presence of physical media that actually is really important to the atmosphere of this film, I think. And that's in the writing, but it's also in the way that the film is staged and visually presented. But it was really just because, like I was saying, we lived through all of that stuff as well, and we wanted it to be. And the Lenore character was great for that. That Lenore became a great kind of, what's the right word?
Vessel.
Yeah, exactly. Lenore ended up becoming the character of Lenore, as well as the film Lenore, both ended up kind of becoming a vessel for all of this, like I say, cultural detritus that we were both really interested in. And somehow it's all in there, which is kind of amazing to me that one character can contain all of that.
It could be any time, any sort of thing, because you do sort of have the technologies from different times and it's all just, but at the same time, you kind of imagine somebody who is into that is going to have all these different things anyway. So I think that kind of fits, but yeah, Lenore kind of reminds me of many different things, just even earlier performative artists to how people are now. Everything's kind of documented, but I think it's done in an interesting and different kind of way, because you're sort of taking different elements of things that may like have happened, but twisting it around and just kind of making something itself. Like it feels very unique, even if you have a lot of influences. I think the important thing is you make it your own thing, which this very much is.
Oh, well, thank you. No, I appreciate that. I think it's a testament to everybody involved in the thing that all of this sort of esoteric stuff is able to kind of live happily within the one film and not feel like it's competing with any other thing. And like I say, that Lenore character was a really great place to sort of house a lot of that stuff, because we're charting, the film charts, admittedly out of order, but it does chart a pretty big chunk of this performance artist's life, from sort of fledgling early days all the way through to sort of borderline poppy-esque transgressive performance artist at the other end. And figuring out all of the spaces in between that was where the fun was, I think, for both of us.
Yeah, and it's weirdly relatable, because I remember having my dad's video camera and doing the exact same things that she was doing. And it's just like, oh, wow, yeah, I remember being this age and doing this. Like, I think that just, maybe it's just being born in that certain time, you have these memories, like it resonates a lot. Sorry, Bede, I feel like I cut you off a bit.
No, that's all right. Well, I was going to say, like, one of the things that sort of struck me about the film is the many influences that Dave and Josie's put into the screenplay. Obviously, there's a lot of Edgar Allan Poe stuff, which is
Nevermore.
Exactly, Nevermore. I mean, it is put out there, and so it's obvious, like, when you see a title like Lenore, you think, oh, okay, Edgar Allan Poe, but obviously he's both put references to his work in it. I mean, I picked up, of course, a bit of Telltale Heart, a bit of The Black Cat, and obviously The Raven.
Mm-hmm.
Nevermore. Just got to say that again. But also, too, in terms of film, I mean, in terms of writing and filmmaking influences, Marcy, I know you said you picked up a lot of David Lynch in the work as well.
The Davids in there, Lynch.
Yeah, I picked up.
Like,
yeah,
I feel like you guys might like the same things I do.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, probably David Cronenberg was probably the biggest influence in terms of your approaches.
Like there's Videodrome-esque things as well as some body horror.
Yes.
I mean, even the name Max Wren sounds like a name of a Cronenberg character. And I even sat there thinking like, I'm sure I've heard this name somewhere before in a Cronenberg.
It doesn't sound like a video. It doesn't sound like the name of a Videodrome character. It is the name of a Videodrome character. It's spelled differently.
That's what was bugging
that
me.
That's literally James Woods's character's name in.
Yeah.
And also Veronica, like the name Veronica Brand is a hybrid of, I think it's Veronica, Debbie Harry's character in Videodrome and Gina Davis's character in The Fly. It's a hybrid of those two names. And so Cronenberg's all over this thing. But as Josie said earlier, like this is one of the things that we bonded on all the way back in film school. Like one of the earliest short films we made is a body horror film about pregnancy. Like it's a, we've been interested in this subject matter for a really, really long time. And so I think we bonded over that very quickly. But as we worked on it more and more, and as we talked more and more about, because I think most of our work was just sitting there with what I'd already come up with and really interrogating it and really going, what are you trying to say here? And as the more we did that, and maybe Josie, you can talk to this as well, but the more we did that, I think the more the pose sort of started to fall into the background, and the more this kind of parasocial element that we were interested in started to sort of come through.
I think so. I think we're both incredibly interested in internet sort of anthropology or internet sort of archivist histories. And so I think through working through, I think the character work, we started to be like, hey, what are the actual theme? Like, what are we, because we kind of went on a journey of like what we were trying to really pull out and say with the piece. And I think we kind of, in the work that Nick did with the Max character and the work we did on Lenore, I feel like that kind of like, it went on quite a, like we quite almost chased our tails for a while around that. But it does strike me that the thematic work that we went into kind of traced almost the lineage that you were speaking to, Marcy, of that sort of 90s into 2000s, 2010s internet history. And I think maybe that's why it feels familiar, because it's pulling on all of those sort of almost tropes of what you would expect an influencer's career to sort of have happen, but then sort of amplifies them to that horror or like psychological or body horror scale. So I think, because we're just broadly obsessed with these things, it's a pleasure and a joy. So I think maybe the length of time and all of the layers and layers and layers of references that you're getting is because that's what we are obsessed with. And I think then the textual elements of the film itself like amplify that even further, because we're stacking technology on technology quite literally. So intentional, but also so fun for us.
Absolutely. something I think we found, I remember many moments from when we were working on it together, but I think we came to a place, I think something that we both sort of got very interested in is the idea that that everybody's kind of liable to fall prey to this kind of parasociality, that everybody is just a few bad decisions away from becoming the thing that they say they hate. And so, because I was really interested in that, like, because the Max character is effectively sort of lying to you throughout the course of the film about his own intent. We used to, without spoiling anything, I used to say that Max is squatting in a film that isn't his, and the tension of the film is Lenore sort of slowly pulling control of her own film back off of Max. And if Max had made a series of slightly different decisions, this film wouldn't be happening. So effectively, this is a hell of one man's own making in some ways. And I think that was something that was quite key for us moving forward with it, that there is somebody to blame for this, and it's the perp, basically.
Well, I was going to say with Nicholas, with your performance in the film, and again, not to sort of go into spoilers or anything, since the film is doing the festival circuit at the moment, there's one really effective scene in the film that I really love, was this scene where your character does a monologue, and like a very long monologue that, at least in a lot of ways, like even though Max is a very questionable character, but I feel like in this scene, at least for me, you kind of on some level empathize with the character as well.
Yeah, I think like for, I mean, this is the challenge of storytelling when you're centering your story around someone who is essentially a bad person, and I'm not playing the character anymore, so I can judge away. That's an old acting trope of like not judging the character while you're playing them. I think I've just pulled a Marcy and my thought just flew out of my brain.
The monologue.
Yes, thank you, David, for directing me once again. I think that just by virtue of spending all this time with this guy, where he is in a place that, granted, he is crafted, where his innermost angels and demons can sort of spill out onto the floor, inevitably, as human beings, we are going to find ourselves empathizing. I think the thing is that an audience, and I think we've had some of these responses, is like people empathizing and then feeling a bit gross that they empathized with certain moments. Because at the end of the day, like in this guy's mind, he can't understand why things are so bad. I listen to heaps and heaps and heaps and heaps and heaps and heaps of young men in the incel community being interviewed. There's a really good podcast that sort of started coming out back in, I think, 2016, which I think is just called the Incel Podcast. I forget the name of the woman who ran it, but it went for years, just exploring like this subculture. And some of the people that they interviewed were just like, you know, pretty bad. Mm. But the young guys in particular, which is also in part where Max's vocally, where his voice comes from. It's like I found myself listening on public transport to these guys talking and almost being brought to the point of tears, because it's like some of them know, like they know what is wrong. They know what is wrong with them. And some of them don't, but they're so close. And it's their choice, the choices they make off their misapprehension or the way in which just sort of society, you know, with its sort of Western beauty standard and naturally unjustness, turns them to make these decisions, which you just like, you almost feel like a big brother going like, stop, 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 stop. So I understand that, like that sense of like, when you see Max like that, he literally is most vulnerable and most childlike, and he's trying his best to have his romantic drama moment, let's say, his romance novel moment. And it's just, it's like, this is, no, it's not going to work, mate, but I understand how bad you want it.
And it's heartbreaking because it's so, one of the reasons it's heartbreaking is because it's so pitiful. It's such a, I'm glad you picked up on it, Bede, because I love that scene. I love that monologue. And I remember filming that monologue. I'm sure you do as well, Nick. We only did it three times, I think.
Three times.
And because I come from a theater background, I tend not to watch the monitor when we're shooting stuff. And so I was sitting, when Nick did his first take, I was sitting on the staircase in the room, just watching him do the monologue in the room. And I got, like, I wrote the fucking thing, but I got incredibly moved watching it, because for all of those reasons that Nick is saying, that it's so, it's like he's just one step away from realizing the error of his ways. But he can't quite do it. He can't quite get there, because these people like this live in this very flimsy reality that they've set up for themselves. And a slight breeze can knock the whole thing down. So because of the precariousness of the circumstances that Max has set up, and just how fragile this love story that he's built is, you really get the sense that this is his last ditch attempt to sort of say something genuine and meaningful, something that really properly comes from the heart. And it's heartbreaking. It's genuinely heartbreaking because it's so pitiful. And yeah, like I say, I'm glad you picked up on that, because it's a very But there is also, there's a line early in that monologue that I think is kind of key to it. He says something like, please don't make me hate you for making me hate myself so much, which is a very toxic thing to say to somebody. Like, you, like, how dare you make me hate me by making me hate you? It's a very sort of gaslighty thing. So even in the course of trying to be sincere and poetic, he still can't help but make it about himself. And that's what, and these people are always a very, not always, but a lot of the time, these people are a very dangerous and very scary combination of complete and utter self-pity, self-hatred, and self-loathing combined with a hell of a lot of narcissism and a hell of a lot of self-involvement and self-importance. And somehow these two things as living side by side, but they're constantly bashing into each other. And quite apart from anything else, I think that is what makes Max an interesting person, an interesting character to watch on screen, and probably partially why, Marcy, you found him so, you got
uncomfortable.
I've been around people like you too much. Mm. I've been traumatized by people like you too much. Go away. I'm glad that you look very different to how he looks in the movie, so you're not as unsettling.
Yeah, trust me, my wife is real happy about that too.
Something that I just was thinking as I watched the film, just I think more, I guess in the past few years, we hear more about parasocial relationships. It has like a name. But again, yeah, watching the film, it kind of almost in a way reminds me, like, it's not anything new. And especially growing up through the 80s to the 90s, just how big like pop culture things were. And again, you mentioned the person who stalked Bjork, and even, you know, you go back to people who've killed their idols. I think Jodie Foster had one. There was quite a number. And it just, it almost struck me as just how it's changed, but not really. There's just this, now there's just more access to form these relationships. And I think the way that this film goes about it, how we're almost seeing like this guy has access to when she started, and it's just all very unsettling. But I think it examines that kind of dynamic in a way that you see it through different lenses of how that happens. And I don't know where my question was, but I'm just pointing that out. And
well, we had a lot of conversations about, oh no, so I've been talking way too much, Josie. You go.
No, you go your thought and I'll go after.
I'll try and handball it. We did speak a lot about a condition called erotomania. I think I'm getting the right condition. Where like these people, they have convinced themselves, like this fantasy forms in their mind that they cannot separate from a reality for themselves, where they have a relationship with these celebrity people, or not even celebrities, sometimes it's like a neighbor or somebody who they work with, and they're just convinced that that person is sending them signals and messages confirming a romantic relationship. That was very much what Ricardo Lopez had with Bjork. That's what I believe, I can never remember his name, but the man who murdered John Lennon. He was
Mark David Chapman.
And incidentally, John Hinckley was the guy who had the obsession with Jodie Foster.
Yep.
And did he try to kill a president somewhere?
That was right.
He tried to shoot.
There we go.
Yeah, he did. But there was also, I think his name was Robert John Bardot, who murdered, is her name Rachel Schaefer? It was a similar story again, where this man.
I think I know what, yeah.
Yeah, you can tell that now that it's two, three years have passed since I filmed it, that I've been trying to purge some of this from my brain. But that was sort of a consistent thing, where a lot of the times these guys were just convinced that, like, in this song, in this episode of the TV show, in this commercial, they were talking to me, they're saying this to me, and what they're trying to tell me is this. That's a lot of what, like, there's a subplot in the film about Lenore's father, which, you know, a lot of that is to do with what Max believes he's being told. But I'll pass that over to Josie. Something.
I was just thinking, Marcy, to your point around sort of being a woman on the internet and having those experiences with men of this spectrum, it is everything from weird comments through to actual stalker. And I think we were also looking at sort of that third wave of sex positive feminism in the Lenore character, which is sort of the inverse of like a character like Max getting these signals, because women are putting themselves online, presenting themselves, doing what is completely within their rights and should be completely safe to do, which is doing performance art, being creative, putting their art into the world, and then to have it misread or misunderstood, and that constant ongoing dance of safety and fear when you've got this sort of blurring between fantasy and reality, but you're also doing performance and self. It's this ongoing sort of like mishmash that is like, at some point you kind of lose sense of who you are versus the character versus the performance. And I think a lot of us now, as we've moved forward, like I think David and Nick, you were talking about sort of the influences of on the Max character, but it strikes me that now we've got looks maxing, which would be sort of like the logical landing point for someone maybe like Max today, if this was written now.
Yes.
And how fast that's even moved in the several years since we completed this project. So yeah, I just wanted to flag that we also were sort of thinking about it in that sort of masculinity, femininity side of things, and how the act of performance and putting yourself and using lenses in the camera to sort of put your own self forward like that, the other side of that is that then you have people perceiving and receiving that without maybe your consent in a way that you would anticipate or expect. And that's quite terrifying. And I think a lot of women probably, and other people probably relate to that. Yeah.
And I do think if Max was in the now, he'd be in the manosphere trying to get on some dude's podcast or something. Yeah.
That'd be an alternative version where, yep, Nick, you would have to really bulk up and just
look as... the clavicular edit.
Yes.
Oh, my God. Well, as I was talking about those incel guys before, it's weird because I know what a toxic little thing he is. But I feel that same way about Clavicula sometimes when I hear him talk. Every now and again, I'm just like reminded that, like, dude, you're 20. He started doing this crap when I think he was 17, 18. He's destroyed his relationship with his father. He's destroyed his relationship with humanity at this point, to the point where he's drugging himself out in public. Like, it's gross. I have sympathy for a character like that, and less sympathy for the guys who are pushing 40 who are doing this kind of crap. But someone like that who's just a kid, it's like, yeah, we're now seeing the further mutating effects of those sort of manosphere characters and the effect that they've had on our children.
But also too, I think what's important about this film, and this could probably be a good way, unless Marcy, of course, you have another question.
I was probably just going to compliment just honestly how unsettling things made me, even just like the sounds of certain things, the visual look, like I said this where we interviewed a writer director last month or the month before, and I'm like, did you just make this movie just for me? Because I had a fantastic time, and almost feel like saying, did you just make this just for me? Because this is exactly the kind of film that just gets to me on
such a good feeling. It's such a nice feeling, isn't
so
it?
So just I don't have a question, just saying like, well, hey, did you make it for me? But that's not a real question.
Yes.
In a word, yes, we did.
Yes.
Yes, we did. Actually, Josie came into the room and said, I've got a friend I want to make a movie
for.
Yeah,
exactly. I mean, if it was more for me, there would have been like a wrestling match in there somewhere, but I don't think that would have fit.
There was a wrestler on set at one point.
Yeah, so true.
We tried. I won't tell you about all of the original endings for the film, but a cage did drop in at one point. So
that would have been
sick. I hit a cop with a metal chair.
Yep.
Yeah. Add in some.
But seriously, Marcy, thank you. Thank you very much for saying that. It really does mean a lot, because you make these things and you can only really use yourself as... ultimately, I can only use myself and my collaborators as my guide for whether or not we're on the right track. And you know, I'm a deeply neurotic person, and so I was constantly going like, oh crap, is it working? But now for it to be out in the world and for people like yourself and several others, in fact many other people, have come to us and said like, love what you're doing, keep doing it. Excuse me. And I cannot tell you how much that means to me, to all of us, I'm sure. So thank you.
Oh, well, thank you. Like, again, just something that just hit me on so many levels with different things. Like, I'm feeling so many things watching the film, but just even from just how it looks visually, the sound design, little just crackly things, and I'm just like, oh, I don't like this.
That's
and
awesome.
And then just Max being Max, it's like, oh no, okay. Well, but another thing, like, I kind of clicked to me that this was originally a play, but the way it is, even just in that one setting, for me, it just, I was too engaged with everything that Bede mentioned. I'm like, oh yeah, that makes actual sense. Yeah, I can see that. But I was just too engaged in what was happening to even really think more about it. So
that's great.
If my ADHD is not making me like do other things when I'm watching something, you've done a good job.
Well, I take that as an enormous compliment, because it's right on. Because yeah, you're right. It's, and like, I love small films. I love chamber pieces. I love small stories about the end of the world, or small stories about the end of at least somebody's world. And this is very much kind of this very much scratches that itch for me. But being a single room, but taking place more or less in a single location, there's a lot, you have to do a lot to keep that alive. And so I appreciate that, because that's something that you get worried about. It's like, oh God, people are going to get bored, people are going to get restless. But no, if you get on the same page as the film, I think you go with it, you will have exactly the experience that you had, Marcy.
Yeah, and I think again, like Nick, like you're in this just about every scene, I think. Mm. I mean, it goes to you as a performer to keep someone who's utterly terrified of your character or the character you play completely invested in what the hell's going on. So,
what fucked up thing will he do next?
Yeah, I don't want to know. Gonna keep him away from those incel podcasts and manospheres and stuff.
Anyway, yeah, he's banned from the internet for at least a month.
To get off the internet, kid.
Yeah, we got rid of his 4chan gold account. So
you can't say anything about my Twitch Prime.
No.
Almost did a spit take, thank you.
Well, I will say, I guess, before we wrap up this interview, I do have one last sort of question to ask. And even though we have talked a lot about Max throughout this whole interview, we should talk about Lenore, because the movie is named after her. But I think one of the important things that I think all of you did really well with this film is, like, yes, we spent a lot of time with Max, get to know his psychology, get to know him, but you also make sure that Lenore also has a voice in this film.
It's almost like she's breaking through. And I think you alluded or mentioned that earlier, David, that she's trying to claim back her film.
Yes.
So it is, yeah.
Especially because in regards with what's going on in our world today, where it seems like, I guess, the monsters of this world are kind of taking the attention away from victims and all that. So I think it's good that at least, like, with this film, is that Yuzel made sure to at least give her a voice, and that she's not a character who just appears every now and again in these sort of artistic video logs. There are moments where you get to see her being vulnerable, be who she is, and getting a real sense of who this character is and what she is going through emotionally. So was that also important to make sure that this character also had that voice in there as well?
Completely. I think that was super critical for Josie. As Josie was alluding to earlier, there is a lot of second and third wave. There is a second, third wave feminist underpinning to that character. And that was something that we sort of developed together. I think, I mean, when I was working on my own, I always knew that Lenore/Veronica was going to be an internet performance artist, but maybe not specifically what her subject matter would be, maybe not specifically what kind of things she would be interested in making, what kind of stories she would be interested in telling. And so a lot of the work that Josie and I did was exactly as you alluded to, Bede, which was, okay, who is this woman and what does she care about? What's she passionate about? What things are intrinsic to her that have absolutely nothing to do with Max's perception being foisted upon her? But then in addition to that, yeah, making sure that where has she been? Where has she come from? And critically, never ever letting her be sidelined. It was very important to us that she sort of hang over the entire film in this kind of, because it is a ghost story at the end of the day, ultimately. And so she does sort of hang over the entire film as this kind of omnipresent wraith-like thing. And I think that comes through in Nick's performance. I think there's a sense that he always feels like, there's a sense in which he feels like he's always being watched by her. And that was really, but it's important that those two characters don't feel that one of them doesn't have any more power than the other. And in fact, that one of them actually wrests more power back off of the other. And so a lot of the work that Josie and I did together as the co-writers of the thing was building that up and making sure that if you pulled Max out of the film entirely, Lenore would still have a completely satisfying arc in and of herself. And that you could just as easily, as I say, take Max out of the film and it would be a satisfying film, just the story of this performance artist who at the peak of her career is disgraced by this act of almost revenge pornography in a way that forces her into hiding, and then what happens as a result of her going into hiding. And so, yeah, that was something that we developed together. I assure you that that wasn't in my, it was alluded to in my initial drafts of the film, but it didn't fully come to fruition until Josie and I actually got in the virtual room together and kind of tore it apart and built it back up again in something. Am I more or less correct on that, Jay?
For sure. I think we always knew we needed Lenore to be this like huge counter thing. And I think it was also like a fun excuse to go bring in all the elements of women and female presenting folks that we had admired and wanted to sort of draw in elements from for all
the exactly.
But it just, I think Hot Girl on the Internet canon event is watching the mask of a man who's in your thrall slip when he realizes that you're a real person. And I think that's something that really, really we wanted to explore, because obviously Lenore is someone who is utilizing and in some ways literally weaponizing her image and her sexuality for her own artistic pursuit in a really like cutthroat, ruthless way. I know so many women who are a Lenore-esque figure, and a lot of their stories and my own stories and our stories are sort of brought in to her reality. But I do think that like, yeah, it was an extreme fun exercise to try to like make that make sense for a single individual person. But it like fills me with joy to know that other hot girls on the internet are resonating with Lenore, because she is them, we are her, I am her. Like it's really cool to see that out in the world and being received like that.
Well, yeah.
And shout out as well. I just want to quickly say shout out as well to Ruby Duncan's performance in that role.
Absolutely.
Ruby's a very old friend of mine from acting school, who I introduced to David to say, like, audition this person, please. And she came on board, like, it was like a month or two before we started filming, so quite late. And she's such an incredible actor and like a daring actor as well, that she just got it, threw herself at it. And then David and the team shot all of her stuff before I even walked on the set, like all of those sort of vignettes and stuff. And it was so incredible to come onto set, see her work. And there's always that worry of when you're an actor sort of on your own in a space, being like, what am I going to react off here? And it was so easy just because of how potent her work as Lenore was.
Yeah.
And her monologue, I guess it's like at the end, is just really just well done, but just very powerful too, where she's not Lenore. The mask is off kind of monologue that she does. I just thought that was so fantastic too.
Oh, thank you.
Definitely credit.
When she takes that takes that wig off and sort of lets go of this this persona that's sort of been hanging off of her for a really long time. And as she said, she is of me, but she's not me. She's me as seen through a lens.
It hits hard too.
Yeah, and as Josie was saying, I know my fair share of hot girls on the internet as well, and had conversations with them in the lead up to this and going like, what's been your experience of these kinds of absolute freaks who who think they know you and think they own you. And yeah, this, that idea that I'm not in this, there is no tacit endorsement in what I'm doing here and in what I'm presenting. It's a performance. I perform myself as my job, as she says. And I know plenty of women who are in, who do precisely that. And, but it's also not lost on me that those women take an enormous risk in allowing their audience to feel like they're being communicated with directly. And what can happen when people misconstrue that direct communication as friendship or love or trust. And once you're in that position, like that really starts blurring, like the space between performer and audience really starts blurring in those instances. And that gets really fucking scary. And that to me, and I think that's like really good fodder for a horror film, basically. And thankfully we all sort of agreed, and it comes, and it came out as a pretty spooky time. Thank goodness.
Well, I think that could be a wrap on our conversation on the film, Lenore. And thank you, David, Josie, and Nicholas for joining us for this interview and talking about it with us.
Oh, it's such
Thanks
a pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
No, loved
but
it.
Also, before we wrap up the interview today, where can everyone, our listeners, find all of you out there on the internet if they want to see more of your work?
Oh, gosh.
And also where people can watch Lenore if it's currently
screening
as part of Fantastic Film Festival Australia.
So that, yes, exactly. So the film is playing as part of Fantastic Film Festival Australia in Melbourne and Sydney. So, and in fact, I'm not sure, we're recording this on the 29th of April. There's a screening tomorrow. Our Victorian premiere is tomorrow night, the 30th, mm-hmm. at the Lido in Hawthorne. And then we have another screening in Melbourne, another two screenings in Melbourne on the 11th and the 12th, one at the Lido, one at the Brunswick Picture House. And then there's one more screening in Sydney at the Ritz on the 11th of May. And you can find me basically on, you can find me on Instagram at David J.S. Ward. And that's where I keep all of the film, theater, visual art stuff that I do.
You can find me at Nick Jack, that's J-A-Q, on Instagram. And I have no other social media, and that's the ways I likes it.
Me too.
You can find me, so annoying, I'm at Yosisaurus, like the dinosaur, right? On TikTok and Instagram, if you want to look at me ranting about other topics, including men on the internet. So
one of my favorite things to rant about.
Except yeah, about me.
I mean, obviously, I already had Josie on the socials, but I've now followed you, David, and Nick, so I can keep up with all the stuff you're doing too. So,
oh, and also real quick, at Lenore Film
yeah.
on Instagram, mm-hmm. if
oh,
you
yeah.
want to
like
follow
that.
Do
you have like an official hashtag? Like a
no hashtags, because someone told me that they were out, so we don't use them anymore. But you can find all of our festival announcements, all our screening announcements, all our important news. We have some really, really exciting things to share. I'm speaking no longer as the actor, but as one of the producers. This is a little slight role shift. We have some really exciting news that is coming up in the near future, not just for Australian audiences, but for our audiences in North America, in South America, and also in the UK and Ireland. So
well, that's
stay tuned.
Exciting. So yeah, stay tuned. And we do have listeners worldwide. So those that are interested, keep up to date on the Instagram page and you'll get all the cool info.
Chuck us a follow.
I did. You got to be cool like me, everybody.
Exactly.
It's where all the cool kids are. At the moment, all the cool kids are getting around Lenore, well they should. She's a cool gal.
You got to understand like why you do not want to be like Max.
Yeah, and why you want to be like Lenore.
Exactly. Well, there you go, everyone. That was our interview with David, Josie, and Nick, the makers behind the film Lenore. And yeah, that was a really good interview that we did with them, Marcy.
Yeah, that was fantastic. And I hope people get the opportunity to check out the film. So be sure to keep up with the socials and check out Lenore. And be sure to follow Lenore on Instagram for all the updates. So yeah, thank you so much to David, Nick and Josie for joining us. And
and the film is currently playing as part of the Fantastic Film Festival Australia. So if it is playing in your neck of the woods as part of the festival, definitely go seek it out. But before we wrap up the show today, Marcy, where can people find us on the internet this week?
If people want to find us, we are at supermarcy.com, and you can show your support over at the Patreon at patreon.com/thesupernetwork. And of course, you can find the Super Podcast on all your podcast streaming platforms. And that is the mega feed for all of our shows on the Super Network, including this one, the Super Podcast. And I am Super Marcy on all social medias and Super_Marcy on Letterboxd.
Awesome. And if people want to find me personally out there on the internet, you can follow me on Twitter, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd under Bede Jermaine. You can also find all my work over at supermarcy.com. And you can follow my solo podcast, Bede vs. the Living Dead, on all podcast streamers everywhere. So, yep, that is a wrap for this week's episode of the Super Podcast. And we'll see you all next time, everybody. See ya. Bye.
Bye.
Feel it, own it.
Flesh and blood and bone.
You can't film it. You can't see it. You can't touch it.
This is one of the most unforgivable things that I have ever seen.
You really think you're special, don't you?
Today you're going to do it.
Shut up!
Look at me.
Oh, no! No, don't you touch us!
You may have once known me as Lenore, but she shall be lifted nevermore.